There's no one, I'm sure, whom we would rather have to give our first foundation lecture, and certainly no one more fitted to address us on the space age and its implications to New Zealand. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Pickering.
Thank you very much. I guess it was a few years ago that I stood at this platform and gave the Sir Douglas Robb series of lectures on our progress in space up to the middle 70s. Well, it's about time to have another look at it and see where we are now. And I'm very pleased to be back and have this opportunity to address you. Let us reflect that the first man-made object to circle the Earth was launched on October the 4th, 1957, just over 26 years ago. In this short time, a remarkable series of scientific and engineering achievements have made possible the detailed exploration of the solar system, and man has begun to travel through space outside the Earth's atmosphere. This is the era when man first left the Earth and was able to see it as it really is, the small blue planet set in the dark emptiness of space. We're at the beginning of the space age. What does this mean to a small country in the South Pacific? Will New Zealand be affected by these space adventures of the United States, the Soviet Union, and a few other countries? And let me consider these questions. But before we do this, let's reflect on what has been accomplished and where this seems to be heading. In the 26 years since the first Sputnik, about 2,300 successful space launchings have occurred. The Soviet Union has launched over 1,400 and the USA over 800. Most of these launchings have been unmanned, the spacecraft usually communicating to Earth by radio, and in a few cases, parts of the spacecraft is returned to Earth and films or other scientific data recovered. Manned spaceflight has developed from the primitive capsules used by John Glenn and Yuri Gagarin to the routine flight capability of the shuttle, with a crew capacity of 7 and plenty of space for a laboratory or an unmanned spacecraft. With the exception of the Apollo missions, manned flights have been in near-Earth orbit, and these have demonstrated that man can live and work in the zero gravity of space for months at a time. The Soviets and the US are the only nations to have conducted manned flights. And on one occasion, the Apollo-Soyuz mission, the astronauts and the cosmonauts joined their spacecraft together and exchanged visits. Now, space missions can be divided into three categories: the scientific, the space applications, and the military. I will ignore the temptation to make a fourth category, political, although obviously a good many flights have had a political objective as the real motivation. What about the scientific missions? These aim at increasing our knowledge of the universe, and there are many opportunities. For example, a spacecraft in orbit around the Earth can look down at the Earth and from its perspective can see large areas simultaneously. So, for example, large geologic features are visible. Or a spacecraft can sample the fields and particles surrounding it and determine the interactions between Sun and Earth. Or the spacecraft can look beyond the Earth and look out into the cosmos. And in the vacuum of space above the atmosphere, it is an observing platform where it is unencumbered by the perturbing effects of the Earth's atmosphere. Spacecraft, of course, have traveled far beyond the Earth to exploring the Moon, the planets, and interplanetary space. And the missions have ranged from a simple fly past the planet to orbiting a planet to landing on its surface. The Soviets have sent unmanned missions to the moon, in which they have remotely driven an automatic spacecraft around the surface of the moon, and also they have sent a sample of the moon back to Earth. Now, all of these unmanned missions have generated an enormous amount of information about the Earth and the solar system. The manned space flights have carried scientific instruments and added to our knowledge. And in the case of the Apollo flights, the men landed on the moon were able to carry out experiments which would have been very difficult, if not impossible, with an unmanned device. Geology, oceanography, meteorology, atmospheric science, cosmology, planetology, astrophysics, the basic sciences of physics, chemistry, mathematics, and even biology have been affected by data from space flights. Theories have been developed, new ideas generated, old ideas modified or discarded. The space age has permeated almost every branch of science. Now, what about the applications? Space applications include those missions which are flown in order to have an immediate application on some activity here on Earth. The most successful space application is the communication satellite. This is in an equatorial orbit, 22,300 miles above the Earth, so that it circles the Earth in exactly 24 hours. Since the Earth also turns in 24 hours, the satellite appears to hang in the sky. It is used as a relay station for radio communications. Signals are beamed to the satellite. It receives them, retransmits them to a receiving station which might be almost half a world away from the sender. And today, a large fraction of the long-distance communications on Earth are carried by these communication satellites. Many of you must have had the experience of talking over a satellite circuit. There is a delay of about a quarter of a second while the signal travels out into space and back, so that it takes about half a second before you hear your partner at the other end of the circuit reply. This does not sound like much of a delay, but sometimes you may have found that it prompts both of you to be talking simultaneously. Other satellite applications arise from the satellite's ability to look down at a large area of the Earth at one time. Meteorology satellites, for example, look at cloud patterns and see complete cyclonic storm systems. The newer meteorology satellites also observe in the infrared part of the spectrum and obtain night pictures and temperature information. Satellites also photograph the Earth in a systematic manner. The US Landsat series photographs a given spot on Earth every 18 days. These are color photographs taken at four specific wavelengths. The information is sent to Earth by radio, and computer processing develops the photographs. With the Landsat, objects as small as a football field or a motorway can be seen. These photographs may be used for geological studies, showing, for example, the trace of an earthquake fault or the structure of a geologic formation. They can be used to evaluate types and conditions of forests and crops. They can map towns and cities and separate industrial, commercial, and residential areas. They can be used to help locate roads and pipelines or map a whole continent in a few days. Color photographs of the ocean can identify nutrient-rich regions valuable for fishing. The possibilities are endless, and new applications are continually being found as people work with the data. Here in New Zealand, the Department of Scientific and Industrial Research is doing excellent work with the Landsat coverage of the country. Another class of satellite application exploits the fact that in a satellite in orbit around the Earth, there is zero gravity. Experiments are being conducted to explore the possibility of manufacturing new and exotic materials, such as special alloys or crystals, in this gravity-free environment. And already, the McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Company and the Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Company in the USA have announced their intention to develop an automatic factory to work in space and produce pharmaceutical products more cheaply than on Earth. And they hope to be in production in a few years. Earth orbiting satellites are also used for navigation and location on the surface of the Earth. The US Navy established the Transit series of satellites to enable a ship at sea to obtain its location. The principle is similar to navigation by stars, except that this is done with radio and computer, and it's far more accurate than obtaining a fix with a sextant. The system is available for civilian use. But Transit has a shortcoming. If you want very accurate location information, the observations must be taken over several hours. And the U.S. is now proposing a new system called the Global Positioning System, or the GPS, which will give location and altitude information instantaneously. It's usable by an airplane to navigate or by an individual on the ground to locate himself with a surveyor's accuracy. Another Earth-observing satellite, which can be expected shortly, is the satellite designed to observe the ocean. It will observe wave heights, wind directions, surface temperatures, and other ocean phenomena. An experimental version, CSAT, operated for 4 months in 1978 and demonstrated what can be expected from such a satellite. And finally, let me mention the search and rescue satellite. An explorer, a ship, or an airplane in difficulty sends out a radio signal which is picked up by a satellite, which then calculates the approximate position and sends the data back to Earth. Both Soviet and U.S. satellites are now so equipped, and rescues have been made in Canada and other places. Now, what about the military? The military use of space is growing. Systems now operational are communications, navigation, meteorology, and reconnaissance. And as these satellites have proven to be successful, the military have become increasingly dependent on them. By the way, the Soviets and the U.S. are probably the largest users of the military satellites, but several other nations also have some military satellites. There is concern, of course, that in the event of conflict, these satellites will be very vulnerable to attack and destruction just at the time when they're most needed. The Soviets have done a number of experiments with an anti-satellite weapon, and the U.S. is now beginning to develop such a weapon. There are international treaties banning the use of weapons of mass destruction in space, and also banning interference with reconnaissance satellites used for verification of arms control agreements. However, in today's climate of arms escalation, there is an increasing tendency to think of using weapons in space to shoot down attacking ballistic missiles as well as enemy satellites. And both the U.S. and the Soviets have active military satellite programs growing in scope. And this should be a matter of concern to the whole world. Satellites in orbit know no national boundaries, and except for a few very special orbits, they roam the skies over every nation in accordance with the laws of physics, not the laws of man. Well, now, considering these three categories, space missions, space science, the application of space for immediate practical payoff, and the military use of space, where do we go from here? Now, let me at this point interrupt and let me give an illustration of some of the achievements in some of the recent satellites. In particular, I want to talk about the Voyager program, which explored the planets Jupiter and Saturn and is now on the way to Uranus. It was launched in 1977. It's expected to get to Uranus in January of 1986. If all goes well, it will be directed on to the next planet, Neptune, arriving there in 1989. The space age is very young. Most of us can remember when the moon was the only satellite of Earth, and travel to the moon was only a fanciful concept of Jules Verne. And now that we're irretrievably committed to going into space, we should reflect on what this means to mankind. The most important philosophic concept to come out of the space program must be the realization that we are all fellow travelers on spaceship Earth, and that Earth is a small blue planet, the only habitable planet in our solar system. The technology that has given us this insight has also given us the ability to plunder our spaceship and waste our resources, and indeed the ability to change irreversibly the environment of Earth, or perhaps to poison it with radioactivity so that no life survives. The view from space should help bring some sanity into our actions, and this would be the greatest benefit that space exploration could bestow on humanity. There are some glimmerings of hope that international space activities are growing. For example, at the second UN conference on space, Unispace 82, about twice as many nations participated as at the first conference. The US and the Soviets conducted the Apollo-Soyuz flight in 1975. And more recently, the search and rescue program has the two superpowers cooperating with both satellite and ground station agreements. The Halley's Comet missions in 1985-86 will be the first time that the Soviets have provided data for the US to track their satellite, which they're calling Vega, so that more accurate data on the position of the comet will be available for European and Japanese missions. I think this is a very interesting development. Soviet tracking data collected by the US and given to the Europeans and Japanese to help make a more successful Halley mission. The European Space Agency now has 11 members. Intelsat has 105, and Inmarsat, the shipping version of Intelsat, has 30. The UN Committee on Outer Space has grown to 51 members. However, we must recognize that even Intelsat is having some trouble as national and regional satellites are sent into orbit. Nations seem to feel that they must own their own satellite so that they can demonstrate their technical sophistication to their neighbors. When India wanted to fly satellites, it was not content to buy a launching from the USA or France or Russia, but it had to establish its own launch rocket capability at great cost. When the conquest of space was a competition between the two superpowers, I expect the rest of the world enjoyed being on the sidelines, but now everyone wants to stake out his claim. Some of the small nations on the equator are claiming sovereignty over the space above their country, all the way to synchronous orbit, or perhaps to infinity. I hope that in New Zealand, at least, you take a more rational position. In spite of this nationalistic approach, the growing use of space not only introduces mankind to a new commons, which, unlike the ocean, is truly unbounded, but also to a new concept of flight, where national boundaries are completely unrecognizable, and the spaceship travels around the world on a path that can only deviate slightly from that determined at the launching. The view from space is a world view, not a nationalistic view. Continued experience with space must eventually strengthen the recognition that all life that we know is dependent upon our treatment of this fragile blue planet that we call our home. Thank you very much.